Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the drone-choked airspace deep inside Russian territory to the darkened, desperate streets of Havana, the world's regional flashpoints are simultaneously boiling over. Welcome to This Week Explained. I'm Tiana, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Kirvin. And this week, we are unpacking a global landscape defined by maximum pressure campaigns and collapsing diplomatic guardrails. In Eastern Europe, Kyiv is actively rewriting the doctrine of modern warfare. They are bypassing traditional tank maneuvers in favor of a sweeping technological siege that is suffocating Moscow's logistics from above. But as the war in Ukraine bleeds dangerously close to NATO borders, a massive geopolitical knot is tightening across multiple continents. We are tracking an evaporating truce in the Persian Gulf, where a punishing U.S. port blockade and Hezbollah's absolute defiance are holding the entire Middle East hostage. Meanwhile, Xi Jinping is executing a highly visible power play in Pyongyang, and just 90 miles off the coast of Florida, Washington is utilizing a dangerous strategy of regime strangulation that threatens to trigger a catastrophic societal collapse. Add to that a shocking, politically motivated gutting of the U.S. intelligence community at the exact moment global tensions are peaking, and the picture becomes incredibly grim. Are these the calculated moves of a new transactional order, or the chaotic symptoms of a world stretched far too thin? Let's get into the state of play. We will start, as always, in Ukraine. And reading through this exchange between Zelensky and Putin this week, I feel like we're watching two entirely different realities collide. Zelensky puts this open letter out there, and he's essentially calling Putin out on his age, mocking the drone strikes, added a little nice little ping of his it line about hitting St. Petersburg. And then Putin's reaction is to just call it rude and shut down any idea of a meeting. But what really strikes me is the tonal shift from Moscow. He actually called him Mr. Zelensky.
Yeah, and that's a huge departure from the neo-Nazi and drug addict labels that he had been leaning on for so many years now. But you have to look at what's forcing that shift. This isn't some sudden onset of diplomatic respect between the two men. It's the reality of a completely transformed battlefield.
And that's all because of the drones, right? I mean, I keep thinking about the Red Square Parade, holding your biggest military flex of the year without a single tank because you're terrified of a Ukrainian strike. I mean, that is a staggering image to project to your own people.
Yeah, the strategic reality behind the images is even worse for Moscow right now. So what Ukraine is doing right now is basically writing a new doctrine for modern warfare. They've moved away from the classic infantry and tank encirclement.
Because they just don't even have the manpower to fight that way anyway, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And so they've pivoted to a technological siege. They're using massive drone deployments to establish a total fire blockade over Russian logistics. They're hitting oil terminals, Baltic ports, taking out air defense systems deep, deep into Russian territory.
And we're talking like way behind the front lines, like 1,200 kilometers inside. And when you choke off the fuel and the transit routes like that, you're making the actual occupied territories impossible to supply.
And that's the entire goal here. Donetsk and Luhansk might not be surrounded by Ukrainian tanks, but they're being cut off by the airspace above them. It makes holding that ground incredibly lethal for Russian forces.
Which brings us back to the casualties. The human cost of trying to maintain this gridlock is just, it's horrifying. We're looking at around 500,000 Russian soldiers killed so far, and they're losing troops faster than they can draft replacements.
And losing more territory than they're capturing right now. And the real reason that Putin won't sit down at a table in Switzerland or Turkey is exactly that. Now, he's demanding Ukraine surrender the four regions, some of which Russia doesn't even fully control right now. And he's doing that because he needs to project strength.
And obviously, like, why would Ukraine do that? They're doing just fine right now. And they're not worried about what he wants to project to his people, are they? I mean, that is an impossible starting point for peace. Zelensky knows that giving up that land would just buy Moscow time to reload for the next invasion.
That's why Putin's line about a ceasefire only helping Ukraine regroup is pure projection. This is what we always say about Russia wanting a brief ceasefire because they need to regroup and reconsolidate their forces. And right now, Putin does need a pause, and he needs that to fix his shattered logistics network far more than Kyiv does right now.
But the scariest part of all of this friction, though, is the spillover. We saw a Ukrainian sea drone get jammed by Russian electronic interference and end up detonating in Romania. And it didn't cause any casualties this time, but that is a NATO country. That's the second major incident there in a week. It feels like we're constantly walking on a razor's edge with these stray munitions.
Yeah, and this is the biggest wild card on the board. When you have an intense electronic warfare scrambling navigation systems right on the border of a NATO ally, it only takes one bad bounce to trigger an intervention. Now, you couple that with the structural breakdown in Russia's attrition strategy, where they can't outproduce the drone threat, they can't protect their deep logistics, and the political cost of replacing those massive troop losses is getting unsustainable. So we are close to Ukraine turning the tide here, which means Russia's going to have to lean heavily on their shadow allies just to keep the war machine running.
Exactly. And who are they going to be leaning on most? Iran, which is why when you step back and look at the whole map right now, it feels like everything is unraveling at once. We've got this shaky truce between Washington and Tehran that is basically evaporating right in front of us.
Yeah, and look, we're not seeing random violence here, right? And as we're recording, we just saw a finishing of tit-for-tat strikes between Iran and Israel. Now, both said that that was done in retaliation for something the other side did, but that's how we got into this mess, right? And now I'm just now scrolling through some of my feed, and Iran has said, hey, guys, we're done. We finished. That's all. So we sent our message. Israel, U.S., don't strike us back. That was just a message. So we'll see how the night, what happens tonight. We'll go from there. But it's all calculated messaging at this point. And both sides are shooting at each other's assets. They're shooting drones, radar sites, bases in the Gulf. And they're doing this to establish dominance before anyone sits back down at a negotiating table.
And that is terrifying if you live in Kuwait or Bahrain. I mean, air raid sirens are going off, airports are getting hit. It's one thing to talk about calculated messaging, but there's a real human cost here with people just trying to live their lives while missiles fly overhead.
Yeah, and then those Gulf states are caught in an awful geographic trap here. They host American bases. That makes them default targets for Iranian retaliation. Tehran knows striking those bases sends a loud message to Washington without triggering an all-out direct mainland war.
And it all comes down to the money, doesn't it? The stalled negotiations really seem to hinge on Iran wanting billions in frozen assets and sanctions relief. But the U.S., as of right now, is holding firm on this massive port blockade.
Yeah, and look at the competing theories here. You'll see that on one side, people are saying that Iran is trying to inflict enough economic pain globally, like threatening the Strait of Hormuz in this case. And they want to do this to force the United States' hand. Now, the other theory is that Washington, the Trump administration, thinks a prolonged squeeze will eventually break Tehran's resolve.
I mean, closing off a choke point where a fifth of the world's oil flows, it's definitely going to cause pain. We've already seen ripple effects at the gas pump here at home. And that has to be making the White House sweat with the midterms coming up so fast. Maybe not President Trump because he's on another planet right now, but yeah.
For sure. Yeah, he is somewhere else. We would have thought this would be a lame duck presidency, but he doesn't seem to see it that way. And so we'll see what happens over the next few months. But what you just brought up is the political reality shaping the intelligence picture. We've got an administration under immense domestic pressure from their own party, from people within their own party, to stabilize energy prices. And that pressure does give Tehran a certain amount of leverage, even if their own economy is suffocating.
Which brings us to this mess in Lebanon. The Lebanese and Israeli governments actually agreed to a ceasefire, which felt like a rare piece of good news. But then Hezbollah just flat out rejected it.
Yeah, and that's because Hezbollah isn't just a local militia. They're a proxy. They're an Iranian proxy. And look, this is quite different than what we saw in Gaza with Hamas. Now, Hamas is the governing body of Gaza. So a ceasefire there can be maintained because it was brokered with that group. Now, this was brokered outside of Hezbollah's influence, and that is because the Lebanese government wants to reassert control and get the country functioning again. But Hezbollah's leadership, their proxy in Iran, is demanding a total Israeli withdrawal first.
It really undermines the Lebanese government, doesn't it? They promised the world a ceasefire, and Hezbollah essentially says, no, we're still fighting. It makes you wonder how a country can even negotiate peace when a militant group holds veto power.
And this is why Tehran is explicitly linking the two theaters. They're basically saying, you won't get peace in Lebanon until we get our deal with the United States. They're trying, they're here tying the whole region and all of the Middle East into one massive, complicated knot.
Meanwhile, Washington is desperately trying to keep those issues in separate boxes, which explains the frustration we're seeing from the U.S. toward Israel's continued strikes in Beirut. It's just endlessly complicating the broader negotiations.
Yeah, look, the U.S. strategy requires isolating the variables. If Israel keeps pounding Hezbollah, it makes it politically impossible for Iran to back down at the negotiating table. And that's what we're seeing right now. All these local tactical decisions are completely derailing the strategic goals.
Right. And while Washington is completely consumed by trying to put out those fires in the Middle East, you look over at Asia and the board is just shifting under our feet. I mean, Xi Jinping is packing his bags for Pyongyang next week. It's the first time he's visited Kim Jong-un in, what, 7 years?
Yeah, 7 years. And the sequencing here tells the whole story, right? Xi just finished hosting both the U.S. and Russian presidents in Beijing. Now he's making North Korea his very first official trip abroad for the year. And it's a highly visible signal about who really holds the gravity in that region.
It definitely feels like a very deliberate power play. Especially because we've been hearing so much about Kim getting incredibly cozy with Putin lately, sending all those troops and weapons for the war in Ukraine. So is Xi just flying in to remind Kim who actually pays the bills?
Yeah, that's a massive part of it. So there's this growing narrative in the West that Pyongyang has quietly migrated into Moscow's orbit. So Xi taking this trip is a direct visual rebuttal to that idea. Russia can hand Kim some emergency food, they can give him some military tech, but China controls up to 95% of North Korea's trade. They are the structural lifeline.
Which makes total sense when you look at what Kim is trying to do domestically. He's building all these massive new ski and beach resorts, and he needs Chinese tourists and border trade to actually keep his economy afloat. But where does South Korea fit into all this? Because they seem entirely locked out of the room.
Yeah, they are. That Kim sees them and most North Koreans see them as a sworn enemy. Kim has severed all diplomatic communication. So we're seeing that freeze out play out everywhere. When North Korean athletes went down south recently for a match, they wouldn't even acknowledge the South Korean public at the airport.
Yeah, I saw that footage, but even with all of the outward hostility, Seoul is still putting out statements hoping Xi will step up and play mediator. They want him to nudge Kim back to the negotiating table. Or do you think they're just being naive, hoping for this?
Yeah, I think they are. And it's because the probability of Xi brokering a reunion right now is highly unlikely. If you look at China's core interests, it is all about stability on their border. Beijing doesn't gain much strategic advantage by solving the U.S. or South Korea's problems, especially now while Kim is actively touring new facilities and bragging about doubling his weapons-grade nuclear material.
And that's the part that is really terrifying people. Kim isn't even trying to hide the nuclear buildup anymore. But didn't China used to be really vocal about wanting a denuclearized Korean peninsula?
They did, but Right now, we're tracking a real rhetorical shift. When pressed on the denuclearization issue recently, Beijing just gave vague answers about maintaining a consistent position. They're essentially giving Kim diplomatic cover, allowing him to advance that program without bending the knee to the West.
So China is basically tolerating the nuclear threat because it keeps the U.S. completely off balance in the region. This forces the U.S. to pour its attention and resources into the Pacific, which is exactly where Beijing wants us bogged down. And while we are so hyper-focused on that massive geopolitical chess match halfway across the globe, we're kind of losing sight of what's happening right in our own backyard.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of talked about the U.S. being distracted, right? And there is a real bandwidth issue here. So when you're managing these massive strategic flashpoints abroad, the regional crises closer to home tend to get treated like an afterthought until they completely boil over.
And it is definitely boiling over. I mean, when you read about people catching rainwater just to bathe and surviving on one meal a day in Cuba, you realize this isn't just a policy debate anymore. It's a full-on humanitarian crisis happening exactly 90 miles from our coastline.
And the human cost always seems to get buried under the policy rhetoric. But what we're looking at here is a highly deliberate attritional strategy. Washington is essentially pulling every economic lever it has to starve the Cuban government into submission.
You say Cuban government, but obviously it's mainly the civilians that are suffering right now. I bet the government has all kinds of stockpiles and stuff. And they're like, all right, we'll hold out. I don't know what's actually like, huh?
No, I'm saying, yeah, exactly. That's yeah, everywhere, right? You would say, oh, that's every authoritarian country, but it's every government.
Yeah.
The people can't eat. Doesn't matter. We can eat.
Yeah. We're fine. It doesn't affect us, so it's fine.
Right.
I mean, it explains the energy blockades and these massive new sanctions hitting the absolute top of the food chain. I mean, they're going after the president and the Castro family and the military conglomerates all at once. It feels like, well, doesn't feel like it. They are trying to box them in completely.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They're freezing them out of the global financial system and warning foreign investors to stay away from Cuba by cutting off those vital Venezuelan and Mexican oil shipments. The island is literally in the dark. It's a classic strangulation maneuver.
But is a total collapse actually what DC wants? Because if the government completely implodes, you've got 10 million people in a state of absolute desperation. And who manages that fallout?
Right. This is typical of the government, right? This is why regime change fails so many times. And in this instance, if you game out a scenario where the state just breaks down, stabilizing the island would require a massive international footprint. We're talking tens of thousands of troops just to maintain order and distribute aid. Nobody has the political appetite for that right now.
Especially with U.S. forces already stretched so thin globally. I know they floated that $100 million aid package, but tying it to conditions the regime will never accept, like bypassing the government entirely to use NGOs, feels like a maneuver that was designed to be rejected. So we can say, we tried to help, they just wouldn't let us.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It also allows the administration to publicly say, look, we offered a lifeline while still applying the maximum pressure. And you have to look at the military posturing happening alongside this. Moving carrier strike groups like the Nimitz into the Caribbean, it's not just routine signaling.
So do you think they're actually preparing for a kinetic option? Because after what happened with the operation against Maduro in Venezuela, I imagine the leadership in Havana is taking those military threats very seriously.
Yeah, they have to. The U.S. proved with the Maduro capture that leadership decapitation is a card they're willing to play, but Cuba isn't Venezuela. Their communist party and military structures are deeply institutionalized. So taking out a few top figures doesn't guarantee the system collapses.
It probably just hardens their resolve, right? They've survived decades of embargoes by playing the long game. They know how to absorb this kind of pressure and just wait it out.
Absolutely. Their survival strategy has always been asymmetric. They just need to delay and wait for the political winds in D.C. to shift. The real danger for the U.S. is that there's no clear theory of change. If you squeeze them until they break, but lack a plan for the day after, you're just inviting chaos.
And all of this is happening when the U.S. intelligence community is in transition. Tulsi Gabbard just walked away from the DNI role. I mean, we knew there was friction, but abruptly resigning to take care of her husband, the analysts in that office have to be reeling.
Yeah, no doubt. Those men and women need direction. They need quality leadership. And you have to remember, Gabbard's own intelligence resume was pretty thin to begin with. She had the military background. She had time in Congress. She wasn't exactly a career intel officer.
I know someone who would do good in that job.
Yeah, I know a few people as well.
Right. And it had a lot of people nervous back when she was confirmed because of her very thin intel experience. But if that was concerning to people, what we're looking at right now is wild. We've got Bill Pulte stepping in as acting director.
Yeah, and as you know, this is where I get really uncomfortable with the trajectory here. The guy runs the Federal Housing Finance Agency. He's essentially a real estate mogul. So handing him the keys to 18 different intelligence agencies is a very serious, slippery slope.
Well, we have the guy from Real World Road Rules or whatever the heck being our transportation secretary. And we have a Kennedy telling us what's healthy and he completely inverted the food pyramid. It's par for the course in this administration. Trump likes giving his loyal people positions that they shouldn't, have.
Yeah, I agree.
He's even stepping in to handle the president's daily brief, where we are actively at war with Iran. It doesn't track. So let's hear from your perspective. Why put someone with zero national security experience in that specific chair right now?
I mean, I think you said it, Tiana. This is what we've seen with this administration. Expertise isn't the primary goal here. It's loyalty. And there's a strategic concept to this. It's called engineered incompetence. It fits perfectly. You put someone in a role that's way over their head, and they become entirely dependent on the person who appointed them.
Which means they aren't going to push back. If the boss wants to hear a certain narrative about Iran or domestic politics, an unqualified loyalist is just going to nod along and hand him infographics so he can point out the pretty pictures for us.
Exactly.
The reflecting pool being compared to the height of skyscrapers. What does that have to do with anything?
Right. And so they won't challenge the policy preferences with hard, uncomfortable facts. We're already seeing what he's actually been brought in to do. The mandate isn't to synthesize intelligence, it's to aggressively gut the office.
Right. The president essentially told reporters, guys, it is on the record, that he wants Pulte to start firing a ton of people because the office is too big. And this is after Gabbard already cut the staff by almost a third last year.
And that is the real long-term impact of this shakeup. The DNI was created after 9/11 specifically to connect the dots across all these fragmented agencies. That's how we got into missing 9/11. So we had too many fragmented agencies and we tried to get them all under one. So if you hollow out that central hub and replace career analysts with people loyal to a political agenda, and you know how I feel about analysis that's political, you lose the ability to see the big picture objectively.
Which is why lawmakers on both sides are completely rattled, but they probably won't do anything about it. They'll just claim that they were rattled and say they were rattled, but they're like, we can't do anything. Our hands are tied. So you've got Marco Rubio pretending he doesn't even know who Pulte is in an intel context, and Tom Tillis openly cheering on the Treasury Secretary for threatening to meet Pulte.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's funny.
Yeah. This is 2026, guys. But I think it really highlights how far outside the institutional norm this appointment is. Even Mitch McConnell made it crystal clear he won't vote for a permanent nominee who doesn't meet the statutory requirement for a national security experience.
everything about this administration is far outside the institutional norm. Everything.
That's true.
But, I mean, plus it doesn't need to be permanent, right? Trump already said he's just acting and won't keep the job. He can sit there for over 200 days without the Senate doing a thing.
Yeah, that comes from the Vacancies Act, which gives him 210 days. But Congress isn't completely toothless here. Democrats are already threatening to hold up the FISA warrantless surveillance renewal if Pulte stays in the seat. So while it may seem like dark days ahead, it could be a moment that gets Congress aligned. And let's not forget, there is a midterm election coming up that could shake up both the House and the Senate and return the guardrails that were set in place 250 years ago.
We shall see. I mean, that's not the news that we had hoped for this week, as the illusion of isolated, localized conflicts has been entirely shattered. We're looking at a hyper-connected board where individual tactical choices on the ground are completely derailing broader global strategy. The next few months are going to reveal whether this era of maximum coercion successfully forces adversaries to the negotiating table, or if it simply breaks the fragile systems keeping the world running. I'm banking on that one. But we'll be right here on the monitors, tracking every moment. But before we sign off, is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
Yeah, just before we hit record on this one, there was a DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, report released that the Israel and U.S. intelligence relationship is fractured. I don't know if you've seen this, Tiana, but there's a lot of talk of how Israel spies on the United States. Not a shocker to people in the intelligence community, but maybe a shocker to some. Probably not a shocker to anybody, really, right?
Yeah, I mean, no, it shouldn't be.
I think the debate here is former CIA analyst and convicted felon John Caracal went on Theo Von's podcast and basically said, well, yeah, Mossad, they collect on the U.S., but there is this standing directive that the United States will not collect on Israel. The guy's lying to everybody. That is not true.
Okay,
there is
okay,
no standing
okay.
Directive.
Like, what?
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy that he just wants to be famous, I think, because everything that his big thing is Israel is the worst thing that's ever happened. Benjamin Netanyahu controls the West, all this kind of stuff. And I think he's playing towards like the Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens crowd. But you heard it here 100 times. Everyone collects on everybody. This is just known, right? This is not something that should be surprising to anyone.
Right.
But I am looking to get a post out in the next couple days with some information on that.
And also, sorry, this episode's coming out a little late this week. We have been so busy and the internet wasn't cooperating yesterday when we were trying to record. So thank you for being patient. And
I was
going to
say, are you going to mention that we did hit record?
Yeah. And then last week, because we didn't put out an episode last week, right?
We did not. No, it was way too busy. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world.
Yeah. And at home, personally, for both of us. Yeah, so there's a lot.
Sure.
But thank you so much for listening to This Week Explained. We hope that you found it both informative and engaging. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future episodes, we would love to hear from you. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and more, be sure to follow us on social media at This Week Explained.
Tiana, thank you so much. And until next week, stay safe out there.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows.